What's up, everybody? Back here for another podcast. We're going to be interviewing a functional neurologist and chiropractor, Dr. Jacob Plasker. Super interesting conversation. The topic is mostly about concussions. We do talk a little bit about some vestibular dysfunction and how that actually interrelates with concussions. But it's interesting to hear his story. You'll kind of follow all this as we go through. We had an incident as an infant that kind of led to some long-term changes to his neurological function, and kind of that's what introduced his passion for helping those with neurological issues. I said this in the podcast as well, but I've sent clients to him, I've collaborated with him, I've gotten to know him pretty well over the last 6 to 12 months, and he really does great things, and I like his approach to care and how he gets some of the gaps in the medical system helping these folks. And so what we're going to talk about are concussions, we're going to talk about evaluations, treatment plans, how to define a concussion, as well as maybe what some treatment would look like and how the vestibular system is involved in concussions and how we manage the vestibular system in general. I think it's very interesting. I think you guys will dig it as well too. And I'm excited to kind of learn more about this stuff along my own career path. And it's a niche I want to get more into too. So give it a listen. I know you'll enjoy, and I want to again say thanks to Dr. Plasker for making the time. All right, Dr. Plasker, thank you for taking the time to chit-chat today. I'm excited to learn from you as from all my guests, but I've been seeing a lot more concussions. I've been sending them a lot more your way, and I've seen good results. That's why I invited you to talk today, but I also just want to learn about your evaluation process, how you view like how concussions develop and just long-term management of concussions. But before we get into that, can you just give our audience a background of who you are, how you got into what you're doing, and kind of your clientele or your demographic that you mostly work with?
Yeah, sure. So thank you, Nick, for having me here. Yeah. I'm Dr. Jacob Plasker, and I am a functional neurologist, which is a board certification within the chiropractic profession. And I have a practice right here in Bend, Oregon, where we treat three patient populations primarily. We treat post-concussion syndrome, that comprises about 50 to 60% of my practice, and then the other, 40 to 50% it comprised of children with developmental disorders, vertigo, different sorts of balance issues, as well as a minority of post-stroke and some neurodegenerative conditions, things like that. And I got into this work because I myself had a brain injury when I was 10 months old. Doctors told my parents I would never walk or talk ever again. And wow. My dad, who's a chiropractor, he adjusted me in the hospital room, and I instantly became responsive. Huh. And then fast forward, I'm 20, and I, after not having any significant improvement in my functioning as I saw it, I saw a functional neurologist in Atlanta, Georgia at Life University, which is the chiropractic school that I attended, and saw incredible changes in my cognitive abilities after thinking that I kind of had gotten the most out of what I could get. So that sort of set the stage for me getting interested in different neurorehabilitative techniques, and so now I employ those in my practice today with my patients.
So I know you were 10 months old when this happened, but like, how do your parents tell the story in the hospital? Were people just dumbfounded that like the adjustment worked, or like?
Yeah, no one expected it. In fact, I think the nurses threatened to call the police on my dad.
Yeah, I could see that being an interesting story, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, but so I rolled backwards off of my parents' bed and landed on my head. And
got it.
And caused an anoxic brain injury.
Got
it. A stroke for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And so now I have hemiparesis on my right side.
Okay.
And that's what I got.
So then your practice here in Bend, how long have you had your practice?
Correct. So we've been open since September of 2018.
Okay. Okay. And then just curious how like your clinic setup works, like how long is like a normal
session with your clients? How often do you usually see people, like frequency-wise?
Yeah, so everything is highly individualized. We have a couple of programs that are employed a little bit more frequently. Everything ranging from, you know, a visit a week or a visit every other week to what we call our intensive programs, which is reserved for people who are really struggling with a whole bunch of symptoms that are making their daily activities almost impossible. And that program looks like it's basically one visit every hour and a half to 3 hours for four visits per day. And that is an entire week.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. When you're in a hospital and you have a stroke, you go to whatever, I'm a PT, you go to PT two or three times a day. But when you're not in a hospital, like, you go to the PT once a month. It's just, it's interesting how the frequency changes, but I don't think the needs change. Why does it? Yeah, I don't know. Is it insurance that dictates that? And that's why people only seek care once a week? Or, I mean, what you're describing makes complete sense. If I have an acute, high severity neuropathology of any variety, I need that constant, you know, reinforcement and training. If I see you once a month, how am I? Yeah, it's just not going to have the same results. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's not done that way as kind of a standard of care.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just like, you know, at the core of what we're trying to do is change a brain, right? And when you're trying to change a brain, whether it's, you know, like if you're trying to learn guitar, right? If you practice once a week, you're going to learn the song, but it might take you a year.
Yeah.
Right. And but if you practice multiple times a day, those pathways are going to be strengthened in your brain, and it's just going to result in the achieving the results that you want in a shorter period.
Yeah.
And so when that, you know, so if we compare that between learning a song, which is a hobby, to you know, being able to walk on uneven ground or drive a car or use a computer, you know, those things are really important in people's lives. So
Let's get into some background info before we get into like concussion management. So what's some, like, let's say someone has a concussion. First off, what is a concussion? What is classified as a concussion versus, I don't even know what would be the grade less, like a stinger or something like that. But like, when is a concussion a concussion, and what's happening at like the brain and cellular level in that case?
Yeah. So the definition of a concussion is a little bit nebulous. You know, in the literature, you see like mild traumatic brain injury, or moderate traumatic brain injury, and the severity of grading of traumatic brain injuries, which are based off of time of loss of consciousness or different things like that. So a concussion is just you hit your head, you know, or you don't even have to hit your head. You have a rapid acceleration, deceleration of the head on the trunk.
So we have concussions more than you would think. Even if I'm in a low-speed motor vehicle accident, I probably had a concussion at some level. Even though I didn't hit my head on anything.
Yeah, like I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, this becomes really salient when we talk about second impact syndrome, or people who have multiple concussions, right? And the first one is bad, right? And so maybe they've had several different accidents. They've fallen off their bike or... but they've never actually had, they never had an injury that's resulted in them losing functionality.
Yeah.
And the first time that happens, it's very stark, and people are very aware, oh, now I have headaches, or now I get dizzy, or now I'm light sensitive. And then after that, especially if it takes place within that month or 2 month range following the accident, it doesn't take hardly anything at all to have a reemergence of your symptomatology.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then people really get like, oh, wow, this, like, what I just experienced, whether it's just, you know, stopping really short at a red light, you know, that I've done those things thousands of times before, but because my brain was healthy, I could weather that,
I get what you're saying.
Air quotes concussion.
Yeah.
Right. But now that I've had an injury and my brain is in a state of healing and inflammation, all of a sudden it takes a very minor acceleration, deceleration to create the same consternation of symptoms.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then when it comes to defining a concussion, is it like swelling around the brain?
In terms of what's going on from a pathophysiological standpoint?
Yeah, like a moderate concussion or
So a concussion, you know, or a traumatic brain injury, at its core, what you have is a loss of your brain cells' ability to regulate its electrolyte balance.
Okay.
You know, we're so used to thinking of a concussion as in this Kuh-Contra Kuh model where the brain gets shaken up and the soft brain hitting the hard skull back and forth, which creates bruising and that results in a concussion. Well, that is part of the story, right? The Kuh-Contra Kuh phenomenon is part of the story, but mainly what happens is you get a shearing of tissues. Yeah. And it's that shearing that results in a whole cascade of events that leads to an inflammatory process, and then, you know, the brain cell becomes altered in its ability to regulate its membrane potential.
Okay.
And that's what we know. And so typically with my patients, I describe it as an electrolyte balance because most people are familiar with the idea of an electrolyte.
Yeah.
But so that's what at the core is of a concussion, is the inability of individual brain cells to do their job correctly. And then depending on where those cells are located in the brain, that explains the symptoms that people get.
Got it.
In conjunction with prior injury and genetic factors and all, you know, all of those.
Okay.
Phenomena.
So you have some sort of trauma, you have an imbalance of regulatory electrolytes, the brain then can't function like it normally does, then a stimulus that maybe is easy to withstand becomes more challenging and thus symptoms present. How long, I know that's a variable question, but let's just say this is a somewhat normal, straightforward case. How long does it typically take to bounce back from at least the acute symptoms? I know you can have prolonged concussion symptoms forever.
But. So the literature states that most people recover spontaneously from a mild traumatic brain injury anywhere between 2 weeks and 3 months, depending on who you read.
Okay. Okay.
And so that's 80% of people. And then when you get past that 3 month period, that's when we assign the term post-concussion syndrome.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And what usually drives those cases? Is it the severity of the concussion? Is it predisposing factors, comorbidities?
Yeah, I would say that the state of your brain prior to the concussion, or the state of your health status prior to the concussion. Right. Okay. So invariably, the people who take longest to recover are people who have things, comorbidities like obesity or diabetes or anything that compromises your underlying health status is going to prolong an injury from a concussion, because we're dealing with a ramped up immune response, a ramped up inflammatory process, as well as the damage to the physical tissues themselves, whether that be the soft tissue in the neck, or the soft nervous tissue, or just any tissue damage. Yeah. As you get older, as you get more unhealthy, tissue damage takes longer to heal from.
Yeah.
Right. And it's the same thing from a concussion. So when people who are, you know, young athletes who are relatively healthy, never had a concussion before, they typically bounce back pretty quickly. And if they don't, you know, that's pretty unexpected, but it does happen, and we see those people quite frequently in our office, just because it's just something people aren't used to seeing very often. And then from there, our job is to find out, okay, what has gone wrong in your brain to allow you to keep having these symptoms.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's get into that aspect then. So you have your client that came in, let's just make up this person. They're 35-year-old skier who maybe knocked their head or something like that skiing. Yeah. What's like your assessment look like? What are you looking at day one? Yeah.
So one of the core tenets of neuro rehab and functional neurology is individualized assessment and care. And the evaluation is basically, everyone's familiar with the idea that the brain and the nervous system controls either directly or indirectly every function in the body.
Yes.
Right. So if I know the area of the brain that accomplishes a certain function, then by looking at the ability of that person to perform that function, we gain an understanding of the part of the brain that accomplishes it.
Like if their eyes are off, you know, that goes with a certain nerve.
Okay. So we put people through a very thorough evaluation that looks at everything from autonomic nervous system evaluation or autonomic nervous system function, vestibular function, eye movement function, balance ability, reflexes, sensory, motor.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything we know that has a concrete relationship to a certain part of the nervous system, we test. And then by looking at what you're able to do and what you're unable to do, we take the totality of the data and say, okay, based on what you're able to do and what you're able to not do, these are the areas of your nervous system we think are most involved. And then after we have that information, we use a receptor-based approach to therapy where we take advantage of our understanding of the relationship between different receptor systems in the body and how they interact very specifically with the different parts of the brain.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that makes, I get it. It makes sense. All right, so they come in, you maybe do some cranial nerve testing, whatever like nerve testing you do. Do you then look at any sort of range of motion test? Do you do like a balance test? What maybe other kind of components are you
The core of our testing, I guess, is three components. We do autonomic testing because invariably, because of what we talked about earlier, where it's shear force, the areas of the brain that are most susceptible to damage by shearing are the fibers that run directly through the center of the nervous system.
Got it.
And those systems include your oculomotor function or your eye movement function, your vestibular function, your areas that integrate your proprioceptive information. So we look very closely at autonomic nervous system. So we do a standard orthostatic battery of blood pressure and heart rate, looking for any changes side to side, and we take blood pressure bilaterally. So we're comparing side to side. We're comparing the same side to itself when you're under different gravitational positions, so supine versus seated versus standing. We auscultate bowel sounds. We look at tissue perfusion, oxygen perfusion, capillary refill, all those things to get a sense of how the autonomic nervous system is functioning. And I think that that is, to go off on a little tangent, I think that that's one thing that is missing from most concussion evaluation, because if you have poor autonomic functioning and you try and drive more metabolic activity to the frontal lobe, say, well, you might get the consequence that you want in the frontal lobe, but if they don't have the ability to deliver blood and oxygen to the area of the brain that they're using, you're going to make that person feel a lot worse.
Yes.
So autonomic functioning is very important to us.
So is heart rate something you're usually tracking as you go through the rehab?
Like I've got a standard pulse oximeter.
Yep.
And, you know, if we're, you know, and most people are usually wearing it as they're treated. I know what their other signs are, right? So you can monitor autonomic functioning in various different ways. You know, having done this a while, I look at pupils a lot. And so I know if a person's pupil blows out, then crash their autonomic system a little bit. But until I know that person, they're wearing a pulse oximeter. Yeah. And if we're doing anything, I don't care how benign it looks, if I'm just turning your head very passively and all of a sudden we see your pulse oximetry tank or we see your heart rate spike, we're stopping. And we're starting lower in the totem pole with a more benign exercise until you can tolerate more, and then we progress you that way.
And do you coach people up when they're at home doing that, do they wear like a smartwatch or something and go on a walk and track their heart rate?
If I'm not confident that that's something that I am giving someone to do is perfectly safe for them to do, we don't assign at-home therapy until I'm confident in their ability to do something without crashing their autonomic system.
Got it.
So that is one of my main qualifiers for starting an at-home therapy
process. Yeah, makes sense.
But to get back to your original question, so autonomic functioning, vestibular functioning via balance assessment.
Yep.
We also have an infrared Frenzel unit where we are looking at people's eye activity where their vision is occluded. And by looking at what their eyes do they have some sort of nystagmus? Is there a rotary component? Do they have some sort of ocular tilt reaction, or do they have an elevated eye, hypertropia or a hyperphoria? We look at all that stuff.
Okay.
And then my training as a chiropractor, when people hit their heads, they most definitely are injuring the tissues in their head and in their neck. And so we do your standard range of motion testing, all of your different orthopedic tests to evaluate the structural integrity of the neck, because the neck is just so important to the functioning of the brain that if it's not working properly or if there's damaged tissues, we have to either A, wait until the tissues are healed, or assist them in their healing process via laser or different myofascial release techniques or all the things that manual practitioners are trained in.
Yeah. So then you did your eval, you got all this stuff. What's like your eval education like? So again, I know it all depends on the severity, but do you give people like a time frame? Like, hey, you know, you might need to ramp back heart rate based movements for 3 to 6 weeks, or what's like your spiel like there?
Yeah, so we do a graded approach to reintroducing activity, as per the CDC's guidelines.
Yeah.
And what I tell people is that if you do something and it makes you not feel well, then don't do that thing, right? I think that there is a spillover of traditional rehab thinking into neurological rehab thinking with this like no pain, no gain model. If you're not making it sore, you're not working. Yeah. And with the brain, when you push a piece of neuroanatomy past its ability to accomplish its activity and you drive it anaerobically with muscle cell, that results in hypertrophy.
Yeah,
right. With brain tissue, it results in going the other way.
Correct.
So it can actually make people worse. And so what we tell people is, okay, we're gonna get your baseline, right? Maybe you can walk for 15 minutes without getting a headache, right?
Yeah.
So you're going on 15 minute walks for a week until you can really handle that without having a spike in your blood pressure or a spike in your heart rate. And then we bump you up to 30. And if 30 gives you a headache, then we bring you back down.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just kind of this dance of doing enough to get a therapeutic response, but not too much to where you're driving your brain past its ability to metabolically tolerate the activity that you're asking of it.
So if I, let's say I had a concussion today, what do you recommend people do day one? Let's say, where should they go first for care? What's like the acute management like? You know, they say limit screen time, don't play video games, try not to do critical thinking, don't build up your heart rate. There's like, they used to say like, don't go to sleep, or like, hopefully they don't say that anymore.
Yeah.
But what's like your acute, education like there?
Yeah, acutely, because most people will heal spontaneously, recover spontaneously in that 2-week to 3-month time frame, we typically don't really like to intervene with people until that time period is up. Because if you're going to heal on your own, then you don't really need me. I kind of see myself as the guy who gets involved when things don't go the way they're supposed to.
Yeah.
But, a couple of standard things. One, I think that, and the research on this is mixed, but from a neurophysiological standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. Magnesium supplementation.
Yeah.
Magnesium glycinate, magnesium threonate.
Yeah.
They are very involved, or magnesium is very involved in the regulation of your electrolyte balance within your brain cells. And so it's just a little bit of a bolster while you're kind of going through that inflammatory process. Diet becomes really important because, you know, again, if we go back to what's happening with the cells themselves, they can't self-regulate. And so therefore, anything that compromises your body's metabolic system is going to really be hard on a healing brain. So, you know, your simple carbohydrates, simple sugars, you know, spike your blood sugar, spike your insulin levels. They don't. It's not a good thing long term.
No.
So we tell people really clean up your diet.
Yeah.
You know, stay away from the sugars and the candies and the cakes and. You know, make sure that you're giving your body fuel that is going to, you know, quote unquote, burn clean. And, you know, I think that's really important. And then, you know, limiting the screen time is a really good thing, especially with phones, where you have scrolling constantly and, it's hard on different eye movement systems, which are very susceptible to being injured by a concussion. So we do tell people to take it easy on the screens. You know, what else? And we tell people just to kind of take it easy and rest. Now there, you can go too far with that. You know, I don't want you locking yourself in a room, in a dark room for months on end. You know, you have to be out, you have to be exposed to the factors which are challenging, but you know, there is a dance with that, and we do help coach people through that. And so if I'm going to get involved before that 2-week to 3-month time frame is up, it's usually in some sort of monitoring capacity. Like, okay, this is really not working well for you. We're not going to necessarily give you any therapies for it, but we're just going to make sure that that your activity level is not making it worse.
Got it. Okay. So since you kind of see people later on in the process, is there common things you see people missing or doing wrong? Or like, what do you think we dropped the ball on with concussion management just as a health providers in general?
Yeah, well, I think the number one is autonomic function.
Got it. Yeah.
You know, the fact that that is not taken into account. You know, what I see very often is that people go to really good, really qualified practitioners.
Yeah.
And they get a set of exercises or therapies, which in theory make a lot of sense, but only if you have a healthy brain on top of to start with, right? And only if you have the ability to deliver that oxygen and that fuel and utilize your fuel correctly. And so often what I see is people come in and they tell me what they've been doing with their person, and I'm like, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense because you have trouble with this eye movement, or you have trouble with this balance context.
Yeah.
And so most often the reason why it's not working is because after maybe 2 reps, their heart rate goes through the roof.
Yes.
Right? And then all of a sudden they are driving their brain anaerobically, and instead of making them feel better, it gives them a headache for 3 days. Right. Yep. And because of this no pain, no gain model, you know, they go, oh no, keep going, that'll go away.
Yeah.
And you know, brains are very dynamic. It doesn't take a whole lot to figure out whether something is good for you or bad for you when you have a concussion. And so oftentimes if they come in and like, I've been told to do this, I'm like, okay, great, that's a great exercise. I only want you doing 3 reps.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Until they can do it better. And instead of doing it once a day, you know, do 3 reps every hour. You know, and so we just kind of play with the dosage.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot less tolerance for negative reactions.
Yep.
In therapy.
Do they need scans in that acute phase? Like, what would be indicative of like a CT? Would be like a cranial fracture or something.
Yeah,
sort,
so
right?
That's like, exactly right. After, you know, after about 72 hours, you know, imaging is not warranted.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I see that really bothers me is people, you know, they get frustrated, understandably. It's been 4 months and they're still getting wildly dizzy, or they're still getting nauseous in the car, And the doctor's like, hey, like, it's time to take an MRI. It's like, no, the time for that has passed. What you're concerned about on imaging is, like you said, a skull fracture or some sort of bleed.
Yes.
Right? And unless it's the world's slowest growing bleed, you know,
it's not going to show,
you know, 4 months later. So it just ends up being a waste of people's resources.
Yeah.
You know, I understand the frustration because this population is incredibly difficult to work with, but... You know, when you see people throwing out these really expensive testings and things like that.
And radiation. I mean, you don't want to take an MRI if you don't need to. Okay. Let's pivot to vestibular a little bit. So obviously a concussion can cause vestibular issues. I've seen a lot of vestibular stuff lately related to like upper cervical cranial dysfunction. Yeah. You know, the idea that if you can't move the upper part of your neck, you never actually challenge your vestibular system and all the directions it needs to be challenged, and it creates this new home of a narrow movement pattern. What do you see as common vestibular drivers and issues that originate there?
Yeah. So vestibular testing and vestibular treatment of a concussion is really important.
Yeah.
And I think where people start to drop the ball a little bit is vestibular functioning, right? There are two parts of your vestibular system. There's your peripheral vestibular system, which is the part that actually senses the head movement and transduces it into an electrical signal.
Yep.
And then there's the central vestibular system, right? And the central vestibular system is way more complicated than the peripheral vestibular system.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, to go back to what we talked about, how the central structures in the nervous system are most susceptible to those shear forces, your ascending and descending vestibular pathways are right in the center.
Yep.
So invariably, they get some sort of damage, which is why most people have some sort of vestibular dysfunction. And to go to your point, right, there can be kind of a chicken or the egg phenomenon, where you know, you can have altered vestibular functionality, which results in a locking down of the cervical musculature, because if your brain doesn't have the ability to sense head movement properly, it doesn't like for your head to move, and so it'll lock your neck down, and so you'll get restricted cervical range of motion.
Yeah.
Right. And the way that you know that's the way that's what's happening is that, you know, if you know what you're doing manually and you go in and you release the muscles and you release the restrictions, that will crash somebody. It will make them fall apart because they were using that compensation to keep their head from moving.
True.
And now all of a sudden it's like, wow, my neck feels amazing. Yeah. And your head's moving all over the place. And then they get really dizzy or they get really nauseous. Right.
Yeah.
So there is that piece of it of what came first, the cervical dysfunction or the vestibular dysfunction.
True.
Right. You can have cervical dysfunction, which because your head hasn't been moving that much because of a true cervical restriction, you know, you have a little bit of a dampening of your vestibular response. Now all of a sudden you move it more and that makes you dizzy.
Yeah.
But it's not because your neck is moving more, it's because your vestibular system hasn't been used to being challenged that way.
True. Yeah.
Right. So when we look at vestibular function, we are looking at all of it. We want to know how the peripheral system is doing.
Yeah.
We want to know how the central system is doing. And it's so funny because people will chop up the system because you have the vision therapists who are doing different eye movement exercises.
Yeah.
Well, you can't have eye movement without vestibular function.
Yeah.
And you can't have vestibular function without proper input from the visual system.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's all kind of wound up in this web. And so, yes, vestibular functioning is very important, but it's important in the context of how all the other systems that support it are functioning as well.
Got it.
I don't know if I answered your
question. No, you answered it perfectly. So are you a believer then? I mean, I guess it always depends. But, like, do you think, like, the Epley maneuver is overutilized? Half the people I see that have vestibular issues, they go, you know, whatever. I just got the Epley maneuver and my care was done kind of thing. And I get the logic behind the Epley. But I assume there's more to management of the whatever vestibular system than just turning around.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Epley maneuver is a really interesting thing because
Well, I'm going to interrupt you real quick. What is the EPWI maneuver?
The EPWI maneuver is a repositioning maneuver that is classically used to treat benign positional paroxysmal vertigo.
Yes, yes.
Right? So you turn your head in a very specific direction,
yeah,
and you get really wildly dizzy, and it's very, very terrifying, and it's very anxiety-provoking. For people who have true BPPV are really terrifying. Yeah,
it's like makes you want to throw up.
Yeah, it's
like,
awful.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the thinking behind the EPWI's maneuver starts with the assumption that BPPV is a displacement of inner ear material from your otolithic nervous system to your semicircular canals.
Yep.
And the most common one is the posterior semicircular canal.
Yeah.
So people put their head back and they get wildly dizzy. So the repositioning maneuver, or the EPWI's maneuver, is a series of positioned holds that's designed to essentially, if you think of a hula hoop and a stone in the hula hoop, rolling the stone through the hula hoop back into the place where it originated from.
Yeah.
And when people have true BPPV, it is literally a miracle.
Yes.
I mean, it's just usually one time.
Yeah.
You sleep upright for 24 hours, and then, you know, most of the people.
Good to go. Yeah.
There are a couple of different things we could talk about because in functional neurology, we use the EPWI's maneuvers and different versions of it very commonly to treat all different sorts of vestibular complaints. And I guess I won't call it the EPWI maneuver because I'm not treating BPPV and I'm not diagnosing people with BPPV.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, what I'm doing, I guess, so I'll back up. There was a study that was done where they took people who were confirmed diagnosed with BPPV and successfully treated with the EPWI's maneuver.
Yeah.
And then post-mortem, they went in and they cut the people's semicircular canals open and examined them, and they found a whole bunch of otolithic material.
Got it. So did it right, actually. Yeah.
Right. And so they're like, okay, well, these people were treated successfully, but they still have oneconia in their ears or in their semicircular canals. What the heck happened?
Yeah.
Right? And so that's caused people to really relook at what actually the EPWI maneuver is doing.
It's true. Okay.
And so myself and I have colleagues who have seen really dramatic changes with these repositioning maneuvers.
Yeah.
And the theory behind it is that what you're doing is you're using an otolithic mechanism to basically recalibrate the way the peripheral nervous system, I guess not the peripheral nervous system, but the way that the vestibular system is perceiving gravity. Because
what
you have is a semicircular.
It's more of like a recalibration than putting balls back in a hole kind of thing.
Correct. Correct.
Which, that makes sense too. What's the likelihood that you just perfectly hit a hole in one every time you do it? Kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And there's also a bunch of stuff that gets layered on top of that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's when you get into like your short arm versus long arm horizontal canals.
Yes.
And you just kind of get in the weeds really quickly with it.
Yeah.
But to go back to what the question you posed, yes, the EPWI's maneuver, air quotes, EPWI's maneuver, it can be very effective, but it is not its own treatment plan.
Yeah.
You know, that might be one thing that I do with somebody, and that might be the only thing we do that day. But next time I'm checking, okay, how did you respond to that? And am I okay to add stuff on top of that? I kind of think of that because if it's not a true BPPV and it's not very fatiguing for people, it's a really great low intensity activity to just help the vestibular system start to get back on its feet.
Yeah.
And then we layer different activities on top of that, taking advantage of the changes that we create as a result of the repositioning maneuver that we did.
Okay. I like that. Okay. So if we kind of step back again a little bit, if you could stand on a soapbox with, we're going to go back to concussion management, and just make an announcement to the world, like, hey, if you've had a concussion, or hey, if you know somebody who's had a concussion, like, what's your, like, big takeaway you want people leaving with concussion management, if you had to have someone?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. You know, A, wear your helmets.
Protection.
And I guess that's another, you know, PSA also is like, okay, you know, a helmet's going to keep you from getting your skull caved in, but it's not going to prevent you from getting a concussion. There's no evidence.
Well, I mean,
very, very little evidence.
Locally, someone here recently died with a helmet on, hitting their head on a tree skiing. So, yeah. You're not unbeatable with a helmet
on.
Correct. Just a helmet.
But yeah. I've had people tell me I was wearing a helmet so I couldn't have gotten a concussion.
Oh, no.
Right? And that's just not true.
Yeah.
So both of those things in tandem.
Yes. Great.
I would also say, you know, just anything that you do to take care of your body is also taking care of your brain. Right?
Sleep, stress, diet.
Yep. So
all
falls,
stuff.
Traumatic brain injuries due to falls is the greatest. Is the single most is the highest cause of death in senior citizens non-medically.
Yes.
Right. So.
Besides strokes or something like that.
Correct. So. You know, take care of your body, because people, you know, you're gonna fall, right? And you're probably gonna hit your head at some point. Taking care of your body and taking care of your brain before that is going to set you up in a better position to recover faster and to not be as acute when it does happen. I mean, there are all these crazy statistics, like if you, for every, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but it's something like for every 1% you strengthen your big toe plantar flexion results in a 7% increase in your balance ability.
Yeah.
Right. Same thing where it's like one of the biggest predictors of all cause mortality is grip strength.
Yep.
Right. And that's because these, having a healthy body and a strong body makes it so that if you do trip, you can catch yourself.
Yeah.
Or you can, you know, catch yourself on the ground or just have the muscle mass to absorb the fall.
And it goes with the whole COVID debacle we're in right now, right? The healthier you are, the less severe it's going
to
be.
Yeah, take care of your body.
Yes.
No one means to hit their head.
No.
Right? No one, unless you're like a professional headbutter. Right? So because no one means to do it, there's not a whole lot I can, you know, unless you're going to wear a helmet everywhere you go, which
is no one's gonna
not
do that.
Realistic.
Yeah.
So, you know, just take care of your body. And
then,
you know, if you do find that you hit your head and you're not recovering as fast as you want to, don't wait to seek help. Right?
Yes.
You see these people who wait a year, 2 years before they're like, okay.
Yeah.
Because while we don't want to see you right after the accident, because there's a good chance that you could resolve spontaneously, the longer that you wait, the more ground we have to cover to get you back, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to get back to a healthy weight if you're 10 pounds overweight versus 100 pounds overweight, right? So don't wait to intervene if you miss your window, right?
Makes
and that's,
complete
that's
sense. All right, so the last question that I ask everybody is, theme of the podcast is optimizing your capacity on any and all fronts. What are you doing for yourself this year? What are you trying to optimize? What are you trying to get better at in 2022?
So,
any goals?
I am. I'm. My wife and I just completed our whole 30.
Good for you. Yeah.
That's
not easy.
Diet.
Yeah.
Strength training two days a week religiously.
Sweet. Yeah. So kind of back to the taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
I like it.
And I'm going to see you to
help
with some
PT and wellness.
Some ankle and elbow stuff I've got going on. And you know, I'm also, you know, learning something new.
You know,
I took up woodworking. I'm doing
like
different computer work on the side. The number one, your brain craves novelty.
Yeah.
Right. And so doing something novel is a great way to keep your brain healthy as you age. Learn a new language, learn a new instrument, learn a new skill.
Yeah.
when people become static and they stop challenging themselves, their brain stops working, right? Yeah. So you get into a career and it's all new and yeah. it's exciting yeah. and you're learning new things every day.
Yeah.
And then fast forward 30 years, you haven't learned anything new and your brain yeah. it just kind of starts withering away.
Yep.
And the best way to prevent that is to constantly be learning something new.
I like
right?
it.
I'm not advocating changing jobs.
No, I get it. Something yeah. subtle. Yeah. Crossword puzzles is your new thing for the month or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if people want to, you know, see where your clinic is or follow you in some ways, what's the best ways to kind of learn about where you're at and stuff like that?
Yeah. So the name of my clinic is Plasker Chiropractic and Functional Neurology. My website is plaskerchiro.com.
Okay.
And people can reach out to me directly at Dr. Jacob, drjacob at plaskerchiro.com.
Sweet. Well, awesome. I appreciate you taking the time. I learned a bunch. I know the audience will too. So thanks for stopping by.
Yeah. Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast, where our goal is to help you optimize your capacity on any and all fronts. If you care to learn more about capacity and what we do, go to capacitypt.com or follow us on social media at capacity.pt or follow this podcast on any podcast platforms. Thanks.